Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This week on the Hill, a major development in the push for the Keystone XL pipeline. The U.S. State Department has released its environmental review saying it raises no environmental objections to the project.
Is it a bold, dramatic move or just a stunt? Liberal leader Justin Trudeau kicks all 32 senators out of his caucus. We'll talk about what this means and whether it will actually bring about any change for the upper chamber.
The Harper government kicks off the new sitting of Parliament by announcing the date of its upcoming budget. We'll take a look at the public opinion challenges facing the Conservatives over their new fiscal plan.
And finally, Canadian athletes are arriving in Russia all week for the Sochi Olympics. But threats of terrorism hang over these games. We talk about security in Sochi.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill. A big step forward for the Keystone XL pipeline. The U.S. State Department has released its review of the project, raising no environmental objections. It states the Trans-Canada pipeline, which will carry crude from the oil sands to refineries in Texas, will not add to the problem of climate change. Now, the pipeline has been the target of many environmentalist groups, and while this is big news, it could be months before we hear if President Barack Obama will approve the project.
This is only the latest development in the long history of the Keystone XL pipeline. Louisa Savage is the Washington correspondent with McLean's. She wrote the cover story for last week's issue and has filmed a documentary for CPAC called Pipeline Politics. McLean's political editor Paul Wells reached her in Washington.
So Louisa, I saw your documentary the other night about the Keystone controversy, the Keystone mess as it's turned into, and it seems like an excellent object lesson in how some projects can just be star-crossed. I mean, when you ask what went wrong with Keystone, you're in for a long answer.
Right. I mean, it was really the perfect storm. I mean, there were mistakes and miscalculations, and then there were also just other things going on far beyond Canada's control, and they all came together to take us now to year six without a decision.
And yet there are pipelines crossing the border all the time, and this president had previously approved of pipelines or pipeline projects had gotten approved since he became president. This seemed like a no-brainer. What was the first thing that went wrong?
The pipeline company, TransCanada, was approaching landowners along the route, and they hit a patch of resistance in the state of Nebraska, the last place on earth you'd expect there to be opposition. This is one of the most hardcore conservative Republican states in the U.S., and these are people who you would expect to be in favor of the oil economy. But they weren't. And the reason was, first of all, they started getting these letters that said, here's our offer to you, and if you don't accept it, we will take you to eminent domain court and have your property condemned, and then we'll get our right of way. And these landowners had a very strong belief in property rights. And this was an issue that had become very sensitive after a Supreme Court ruling in the United States that was very controversial among a lot of conservatives that said that property could be private property could be handed over in the interests of private economic development. So this had become a hot button issue already. So that really got some of these people angry. And then add to that, the state of Nebraska is very agricultural, and they have this huge underground water aquifer that they rely on to irrigate their crops. They just tap into it directly and pull out water for their big corn farms. And they started to look over at a spill that happened in the state of Michigan, where an Enbridge pipeline from Alberta spilled a huge amount of diluted bitumen into the Kalamazoo River, and it took years to clean up. And they thought, wow, what if that happened here? And then thirdly, the pipeline route was crossing directly through something called the Sand Hills, which was a very fragile, unique ecosystem in the middle of Nebraska. They put enormous pressure on the conservative governor of Nebraska, and it was he, Dave Heineman, who went to the administration and said to Obama, please deny the permit. We don't like where the pipeline is going. And now you would think that by that point, TransCanada would have moved the pipeline route, but they were very afraid that if they did so, the whole long State Department process would have to start over from square one. So they were quite resistant. And it was this resistance in Nebraska that then led the State Department to say, wait, hold on a minute. We need to resolve this routing issue through Nebraska. We're going to delay the pipeline review by another year.
Now, the other peculiarity of this project, there's an awful lot that happens in the United States that the president of the United States doesn't have a direct say over, including most of the legislation. It's a kind of a ping pong match between the White House and Congress. But this is Obama's alone, and that made him vulnerable to pressure from his own electoral base.
Right. So this was the other piece of this perfect storm. So Obama's elected, and if you recall, he promised to stop the rise of the oceans and made all these grand promises to his supporters, and they took him at his word. And early on in his first term, there was a great amount of work being done on a cap-and-trade legislation, something to cap emissions in the United States. And they almost got it through the Congress, but they just couldn't get enough votes in the Senate. They thought if only Obama had pressed senators, Democratic senators from coal states a little harder, maybe they could have got it through. But he was so focused on getting health care reform that he didn't do that. So the environmental movement and the Democratic base were very disappointed with him on that. There were other things that he disappointed them on in terms of environmental policy. So a big activist in the United States named Bill McKibben turned his focus to this pipeline. And a bunch of activists got together and said, we need to stop this pipeline because it's so big. We're talking 700,000, 800,000 barrels per day. That it will create, it will spur more expansion of the oil sands, was their argument, and that will spur more emissions. So they really focused on this and made it a huge cause. And you'll see in the documentary, there were people fanning out across the country, showing up at Obama for America campaign offices and putting pressure on local organizers, and they were calling Chicago. They were following around his campaign manager. They really stuck this in the face of the Obama campaign people. So then when the Nebraska issue came up, it was just a wonderful escape hatch for the administration to be able to say, oh, we can't make a decision one way or the other before the election, so we're just going to punt it. And at that point, they'd had over 1,000 environmental activists getting arrested in front of the White House, and Hollywood had, you know, joined in the cause. And they were under so much pressure that when the Republican governor said, we need some time here, deny the first permit, we need a new route, it was just the perfect situation for the administration then to delay.
Okay. So up here in Ottawa, we spend a lot of times asking ourselves, what did Stephen Harper do wrong in all of this? It's not clear that there's an answer to that. It's not clear that a perfectly operating federal government of Canada could have changed the story you're telling.
Right. Well, there's always this debate, how much does the personal relationship matter? And there are as many answers to that question as there are people who you ask. I think the analysis here in Washington is this was so much bigger than the bilateral relationship. It was such a big domestic cause that even if they were best buddies, it would have been hard for Obama to acquiesce to this while all this other stuff was going on. But that said, there have been a lot of signals coming out of the Obama administration that what they'd really like to see is some kind of movement from Canada on climate emissions regulations for the oil and gas sector, which the government keeps saying it's working on, but they haven't come out with yet. And that would certainly give the Obama administration some political cover. And also you saw it coming out of the Environmental Protection Agency. And they came out with a letter last spring telling the State Department to please improve their environmental analysis on various grounds and also to look for ways to cooperate with Canada on emissions. So that's been one area where you could imagine the government perhaps doing more.
Well, it's a fascinating issue, and it's a complex one. And thanks for all the time you spent delving into it. So the story was on the cover of Maclean's. The movie, which is on CPAC, is called Pipeline Politics. And Louisa Savage, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Maclean's political editor Paul Wells with Washington correspondent Louisa Savage discussing the political history of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Coming up, the first week of Parliament was full of action with major changes for Liberal senators, or should we say Senate Liberals, and the government has released the date of the 2014 budget. Anyone who thought the spring sitting would be boring was in for a shock this first week back. The government kicked off day one by announcing its budget date, which we'll touch on a little later in the show.
But just a couple days ago, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau dropped a bombshell announcing he had kicked all of his senators out of caucus.
I have heard clearly from Canadians. The Senate is broken and needs to be fixed. As of this morning, only elected members of the House of Commons will serve as members of the Liberal caucus. The 32 formerly Liberal senators are now independent of the National Liberal Caucus. They are no longer part of our parliamentary team. There are no more Liberal senators.
But those senators created their own caucus in the Red Chamber and are now identifying themselves as the Senate Liberals.
So what do these changes actually mean, and where will it all lead? I'm joined now by Rob Walsh, former law clerk in the House of Commons. He spent 12 years in that role and knows a few things about the Constitution. Rob, thanks for joining us here today.
Glad to be here.
So when Trudeau came out and made his announcement, I think a lot of people in the parliamentary press gallery had their jaws dropped. They were amazed by what he was announcing. What went through your mind when you heard this news? You probably thought you had seen almost everything in Parliament at this point.
Well, I thought it was a bold move. My initial response was very positive. I thought he was doing something that was a step in the right direction for the Senate. Now, I don't believe anything of that kind would be appropriate in the House, but certainly for the Senate, it's a step in the right direction.
A lot of people are criticizing the NDP, but more so the government, calling this a stunt and a gimmick. You don't feel like this is a stunt or a gimmick from Trudeau?
No, I don't. That's not to say that it's all that big a deal as some might like to make it. It has its limitations. But I don't think it's a mere stunt. I think it's a very significant step. What you're talking about here is a politician giving up power. Now, that simply doesn't happen very often. He is giving up control, political control, over the Liberals in the Senate. And that's simply unusual. And if it's only a gimmick, or if it's only a trivial stunt, then why don't the other party leaders do the same thing? Well, not the NDP, they don't have any senators, but why don't the Conservatives, the Prime Minister, Mr. Harper, do the same thing if it's so trivial?
But in the end, we saw the senators, who then became independent, go into the Red Chamber. They held up their membership cards. They all declared, "I am Liberal." And they went from Liberal senators to Senate Liberals, and that's what they're calling themselves now. So in the end, what has this really changed for the Senate side of things?
In the immediate sense, I don't think it's changed very much. They will continue, I understand, as a recognized political party, calling themselves Senate Liberals. They will be the official opposition because they'll be the second largest party there, and that will give them the usual support resources and budgets that go with that position. So in the immediate sense, I don't see a significant change in the Senate. However, I think it is significant longer term.
In what way?
Well, longer term, you might see some very interesting developments, but this will depend on the political horizon changing. For example, were it to be the case in 2015 that there was a change of government, and were it in particular to be the case that Mr. Trudeau became formed a government, then first of all, he wouldn't have the support of his Liberals necessarily in the Senate. But more than that, he'd be faced with a majority that are Conservatives. And if they are under the control of the Conservative leadership in the House, then that creates the political dilemma. Like, is the Senate going to oppose the new government's legislation? And are the Senate Conservatives controlled by the House Conservatives? So it creates a very interesting political debate at that point. But short of any change of government, if we continue as we are now with the Liberals in the third position in the House, I don't see there being much in the way of significant differences in the ongoing business, parliamentary business or political business on the Hill.
Now, they're calling themselves Senate Liberals in the Red Chamber. Can there be any sort of challenge moving forward to their status? Because I bring this up because Lillian Dick wanted to become a New Democrat senator, and Jack Layton protested that, and she was rejected for that status.
Well, in that case, I expect that the objection was that she was associating herself with the New Democratic Party, which is a recognized political party in the House, certainly, and of course recognized political party nationally, and that party was objecting to that association, which it can do. So to say in the Senate that you are a New Democratic senator when the party itself is saying, no, you're not, then that presents a difficulty for the Senate itself to recognize the senator as a New Democrat senator. But in this case here, if the senators are Liberal senators are saying they are going to sit as Senate Liberals, if you want to use that term, and no one's objecting, then why would the Senate itself, the Speaker or the Senate majority or whatever, object to them calling themselves that? We had something like this in the House when the Reform Party became the Canadian Alliance, became the Conservative Party. I mean, caucuses can change their names, but that's all you're talking about here. Someone electing themselves into a caucus in the House is not possible unless, in fact, that caucus agrees.
There's an argument that Trudeau did this because he wanted to separate himself from the senators before the Auditor General's report comes out on Senate expenses. Do you think that gives him enough distance now, making this official divide?
Well, I think he already had some distance personally. I appreciate that if there are some bad reports in the AG's report, that may adversely affect the Liberal brand, as it's so-called. But Trudeau himself is the next generation. He didn't appoint any of these senators, and I don't know the Canadians would necessarily hold him responsible for their behavior. But as to whether that was his motivation, I think it's unlikely.
Let's look forward. He's made a suggestion that he wants to bring in an independent body to make Senate appointments moving forward so that he can create an independent Senate chamber again. What do you think of this process that he's proposing of having an independent committee or panel choose the next person to take over a Senate seat?
Well, I think what he's done is launch a debate on this issue, and I think it's a welcome debate as to how senators become senators. I appreciate there are constitutional implications because, of course, the Constitution requires that the Governor General appoints a senator based on the advice of the Prime Minister. But that's not to say there can't be mechanisms put in place to lead to the selection of individuals for the Prime Minister's recommendation. And I think that's what he's done. He's raised the question of whether the Senate, first by his own initiative in separating the Liberal senators from his own caucus, but whether all senators appointed should be arm's length. This is not to say, in my judgment, totally free of any political association, but nonetheless, they should have merit in their own right for appointment, representing the region of the country that they represent, and they should be put in a position where they can be allowed to speak to matters of public interest with some detachment, if you like, or with some objectivity, and not simply be mouthpieces for their political leadership.
There were some arguments when the Senate was debating whether these independent senators could be called Liberal senators, and some conservatives said that it's an impossible thing to create a nonpartisan Senate, and that's something that Trudeau wants to create. So is a nonpartisan independent Senate a reality or just a pipe dream?
It's a reality if the politics will allow it to happen. It certainly is a reality, but it takes... All parties coming together and accepting the Senate in a new role. And in particular, at present circumstances, it requires the Prime Minister to accept this notion and to allow the majority of senators, who are conservatives, to act independently of the government.
Thank you for joining me. Rob Walsh, a former law clerk in the House of Commons.
Thank you.
Now, Justin Trudeau did more than just kick senators out of the Liberal caucus. He also declared that they would no longer play a role as Liberal fundraisers, organizers, and activists.
But Senator Terry Mercer, a bread-in-the-bone Nova Scotia Liberal and former national director of the party, tells us by phone that the leader can't stop him from being active on his home turf.
And if I'm asked by any Liberal association, federally or provincially in Nova Scotia, to help them in any way possible, I will. I live in the riding of King's Hands, Scott Bryson's riding. I plan to knock on doors on behalf of Scott Bryson. I also contribute money to Scott Bryson's campaign. I'm not going to stop doing that because Mr. Trudeau doesn't want me to do that. And if Scott Bryson asks me to do certain things for him, I will be happy to help.
We'll have to wait and see if Senator Mercer is the only senator willing to challenge Trudeau's demands now that those senators are independent of the parliamentary caucus.
Coming up on the show, the public opinion challenge for the upcoming conservative budget, and we analyze the security threats at the Sochi Olympic Games. In an effort to point the political focus onto the economy, on the first day of the spring sitting, the Harper government announced the date of its upcoming budget, with Finance Minister Jim Flaherty rising in the House of Commons.
Economic Action Plan 2014 will continue our government's focus on keeping Canada's economy stronger by introducing positive measures to grow our economy, create jobs, keep taxes low, and return to balanced budgets in 2015. Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to request the designation of an order of the day for the Finance Minister to present budget 2014, Economic Action Plan 2014, on Tuesday, February 11th, 2014, at 4 p.m.
Now, budgets aren't just about financial figures, they're also about polling numbers.
McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with David Coletto, CEO of Abacus Data, about the tough public opinion challenge the Conservatives face as Jim Flaherty prepares their new fiscal plan.
So first, what is the political moment as you see it? If you had to look at the sort of top line information you've got, your understanding of public opinion, what's the climate that the government is dropping this budget into?
Well, I think there's two points to the climate that are related but separate. The first is, obviously, this government and the Conservative Party are down, lower than they've been pretty much, I think, since they were elected in 2006. So they are operating in a climate where much of the public that was vital for them to win, and I talk about a particular slice of that segment, are now questioning whether, first, they approve of the job the government's doing, and second, whether they would even support the government again when the next election comes around. So that's the first context. The second context is broader in that Canadians, while still generally optimistic about the state of the economy as a whole, we've seen some, particularly in the last 3 months, some slippage in that confidence, to the point where it's about an 8-point swing from October to January among those saying that the economy's in a good state.
Budgets, in my memory in Ottawa, used to be pretty simple documents. You know, they had gray or beige covers. They were called the budget and then the year they were being dropped in. Now they're called economic action plans. There's full color. They're fatter. There's a lot more padding and sort of rhetorical flourish around a budget. Is that actually having an effect on the way people view the government's handling of the economy? Do budgets actually matter as a way of selling the government as an economic steward?
I always view budgets as political documents. They're fundamentally a political document. But I think you're right. I think that this government in the last few years has shifted the tone of these documents and also the function that they serve. That, you know, in I teach political marketing at Carleton. Those documents fit very perfectly into this market-oriented orientation that parties are taking, that you know who your segments are, you know what they care about, and you're going to deliver for them.
Who do you think they might reasonably aim a budget at? What segment of the population would they like this to resonate with?
It's hard to define them clearly in terms of demographic descriptions, because I think sometimes we simplify it too much to say, oh, it's, you know, suburban voters living outside of Toronto and Vancouver, or new Canadian communities. I think that's too simple a term. So I look at it in the terms of there's almost four political battlegrounds in Canada. There's the Conservative base, right, which is a battleground in the next election because the government needs to get them to vote, right?
It's a turnover issue.
Yeah, they might stay home because they don't feel that the government's been conservative enough, right, or has lived up to its promise. The second battleground are those that would consider voting NDP or Liberal, right? They're outside of the Conservative universe. They overwhelmingly dislike Stephen Harper. They overwhelmingly disapprove of the government. They will never vote Conservative. And that group's been, I think, fairly stable throughout the 8 years of Harper's government. The two other groups include those that would consider Conservative. And the most important, I think, are those that would consider voting Liberal and Conservative. So much of the Liberal gains has come from this group, who are shifting between, we'll say, free enterprise parties. This group is particularly middle income, if you want to look at where they are. They are more suburban in where they live. And they have very diverse views when it comes to, they're not very ideological. So they view the world in a certain way in terms of, we don't want a large government and we want business to prosper. But on the other hand, we're also a little more socially conscious.
And how big a group is that, David?
15% of the population.
To me, there's a sort of an almost a paradox in the way the Conservatives have positioned themselves on economic matters. On the one hand, it's a broad branded anti-question, right? Who do you trust with the economy? Who looks competent and stable to you? Who handled the tough days of the Great Recession? That sort of stuff. On the other hand, it's niche policies, right? Like, we gave you $100 per kid per month. We are going to bring you income splitting, which I guess is a little more than a niche, but it's still a very, you know, very targeted yes. measure. So there are all those small things, and yet there's also this big brand identity question. Can you speak to that? Do you know, do those things somehow feed each other? Are they actually contradictory ways to think about economic messaging?
I don't think they're contradictory. I think they support. So almost, you can look at them almost at two levels, right? So you've got your macro. At the very basic level, voters need to believe that you're competent, right? And right now, the number one policy area that competence is important is around just making sure that the economy is doing well. So the big economic, we're doing well, trust me over the other guy. That's important for basic stuff, but to actually get someone to maybe switch their vote, I think that the micro stuff works. And I think that's where politics is going.
A guy like Jim Flaherty, who's been around for a long time, enduring, powerful cabinet minister, who seems to have such a lot of importance in the whole history and story of the Harper government, does he actually matter on a retail political level? Does it matter that you've got a long-standing finance minister who people might recognize, or is that a negligible factor?
It's negligible. That's my view. We look at there's a survey done after the 2011 election for the Canadian election study, academic study, and he asked Canadians to name the federal finance minister. 23% could name correctly the finance minister.
David, again, on the context for the budget, we think of the Senate scandal as having really dominated the political agenda last year. In fact, I can't recall a calendar year when one issue just seems so overarchingly important. Clearly, the government would like to change that for 2014. The budget is, in some ways, their first chance to make a real bid at that. What do you have any way of plumbing public opinion on that? What are the odds of shifting people's focus, at least partially, away from a percolating scandal like the Senate and onto a deeply important issue like the economy?
Let me put it this way. You don't shift the public's attention on something unless the media shifts their attention on something. And so that's more of a question for your editors or for you, right? How does the government shift your attention?
That's Abacus Data CEO David Coletto speaking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Still to come, the security threats facing Canadian athletes at the Sochi Olympic Games, and our Maclean's panel weighs in on the battle of the veterans versus the Veterans Affairs Minister. Canadian athletes have been arriving in Russia all week to prepare for the Sochi Olympics, which begin with the opening ceremony on February 7th.
But the threat of a terrorist attack looms over these games. Charlie Gillis is a senior correspondent with Maclean's, and he will be attending the Olympics. He's written about security in Sochi and speaks with Maclean's reporter Adrian Lee.
So since your story ran, there's been some new developments in Russia. There's been a suspected terrorist attack that left 5 dead in a city that's even closer to Sochi, a terrorist sweep that's rounded up 700 people, and there are online threats now of a chemical attack. The NHL has even said that it would reconsider sending players to Sochi if something serious happens before opening day. So, Charlie, how seriously is Russia taking this?
Oh, I think Russia's taking it very seriously indeed. This is their big party, and there is serious concern that big party would be ruined. Imminent concern is that the party will be ruined by an attack within the wire at one of the sites in Sochi or up in the mountains. But it's my belief, and I've tried to make this case in the magazine, that if there were an attack in one of the secondary cities, and if it were a significant attack costing a lot of lives, that too would kind of ruin the party, because, you know, the eyes of the international media would turn toward that site, and, you know, you'd have reporters actually leaving Sochi to go and cover it, and that would become the story. I mean, the story is already that these are the security games, I'm pretty sure that the Russian authorities are hoping, banking on the euphoria of the game's beginning, kind of, you know, sweeping that away and kind of taking over the agenda again. But, that would end pretty quickly if there were another attack.
And between the security issues and the gay rights issues, is this the most controversial Olympics ever?
Well, it wouldn't be the most controversial Olympics ever. Surely the 36 games in Berlin during the in the run-up to the Second World War would have gone down as the most controversial ever. That was a time when Hitler was out to prove that that the Germans were a master race and so forth. And of course, you've had scary incidents at Olympics and horrifying incidents at Olympics. The obvious one being 1972 in Munich, and the terrorist act there, and then there was the bomb in Atlanta. So, It's too early to say that these are these are going to be a terribly controversial Olympics. But in the run up, there has certainly been enough controversy to keep the news agenda full of things that have nothing to do with athletics, that have nothing to do with skating or skiing or shooting. I think that's something that the Russians are getting very concerned about.
So Sochi won the Olympics back in 2007 over the northern portion of South Korea, which on its own isn't exactly the safest spot from terrorism in the world. But why does it feel like we didn't see this coming?
That's a great question. And I think if we're truthful with ourselves, we'll admit that we did see it coming. I looked back and in the day before that the games were awarded to Russia, back in 2007, there were attacks. There was an assassination and I think a couple of car bombings in the North Caucasus region. There had been claims on the part of the Russians that they had turned the corner in that war, and clearly that wasn't the case. And hostilities have gone on ever since, and terrorism has been a constant threat in that part of the world. It hasn't been a threat since about 2010 in what you might call European Russia, the places like Volgograd and Stavropol where there have been recent attacks. But that's because, the militants in the North Caucasus were kind of stepping back and they were waiting to see whether protests in Russia's major cities were going to slow down Putin and kind of, change the regime and change the tone of politics in Russia. Well, that didn't happen. And now Doko Umarov, who I guess is the putative leader of the insurgency in the North Caucasus, has declared that Sochi is a target and all Russians are targets.
So your story in the magazine ends on a note that suggests you see it being pretty likely that there will be an attack in Russia during the Olympics. And this next question isn't to fearmonger so much as it's to give listeners a sense of the atmosphere there. But what do you see as the odds of there actually being an attack?
Well, I think the odds of there being an attack inside the wire are still very low. There have been reports recently that there's a woman... These women are referred to as black widows. They're the widows of Chechen and Dagestani and other fighters who are believed to be prepared to take up the cause and strap explosives to themselves and become suicide bombers. There's a report of one of those women being inside the wire, but that's kind of unconfirmed. So with 50,000 police and troops and then secure a whole bunch of sort of private security personnel on top of that, I'd say it's going to be very, very difficult for anybody to stage an attack on Sochi, on the venues, on the hotels that are in the area where the international media and the support staff for the various Olympic committees will be housed. But I think the likelihood of an attack outside of the wire in some other place in Russia, a high-profile one, is actually fairly likely. I would argue that there's a greater than 50-50 chance that there's going to be some sort of attack. It might be in the North Caucasus region toward, out in Chechnya or Dagestan or someplace like that. It might be an assassination, who knows. But I would say it's better than 50-50. My reason for that is that there are ongoing terrorist attacks. And, in the last year, there were 182, according to the U.S. State Department. And, if you look them up, they're not all small, low-level things either. Some of them are car bombings that took several lives. So the greater question is, will it happen in a place like, an airport in one of the major centers like Moscow, or will it happen in a place like that train station in Volgograd? And if it does, as I say, if it's significant enough, then I think it could be a real spoiler for the Sochi Games.
That's McLean's reporter Adrian Lee discussing security at the Sochi Olympics with our senior correspondent Charlie Gillis.
And now we want to introduce a new segment to the show called Question Period in Review. Nick Taylor-Vasey is the online host of QP Live, live blogging all of the action in the House of Commons on the McLean's website.
He joins us now with a look back at the best political jabs and hooks over the last 5 days.
On Monday, QP sprang back to life after a six-week break. Veterans Affairs dominated the first few days back, and hey, the opposition called for its first ministerial sacking of the year. NDP leader Tom Mulcair, among others, demanded Prime Minister Stephen Harper fire Julian Fantino. In the middle of the week, on Wednesday, Harper and Mulcair openly mocked Liberal leader Justin Trudeau's shocking move to expel every Liberal senator from his caucus. Yeah, after a winter break, that's the kind of week it was. Everyone's home. Welcome back to QP. Let's start on Tuesday, when Mulcair challenged the Prime Minister on Veterans Affairs.
The Conservative government plans to close 8 veteran service centres this weekend. Some veterans will now have to drive 5 hours for a face-to-face meeting. Does the Prime Minister find that acceptable? Yes or no?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister. Speaker, of course, that is completely false. What is happening here is a significant increase in service. There are a small number of service centres that are being closed that, frankly, serviced very few people, had very few visits. That's being replaced with 600 service centres across the country. And, Mr. Speaker, an increased number of cases of employees will actually go, and they will go and meet veterans instead of the other way around.
The PM may have played defense most of Tuesday, but he sounded almost giddy on Wednesday as he responded to Trudeau's plan to remove his own senators from the Liberal caucus.
Mr. Speaker, I gather the change announced by the leader today is that unelected Liberal senators will become unelected senators who happen to be Liberal. In fact, his leader in the Senate said the following in response to his announcement. I'm not a former Liberal. I'm a Liberal, and I'm a Liberal senator. He also said, I suspect that not a great deal will change. That has to be the understatement of the year.
On Thursday, Mulcair pelted Fantino with questions, including this one, in his opening round.
Does the Prime Minister realize that from Cornerbrook, one of the offices being closed, to St. John's, it's an 8-hour drive in good weather? That it's not true that there will be home visits for all of these veterans, and that it is grossly unacceptable to be shutting down services to our veterans when we've lost 8 of them to suicide in the last 2 months.
Fantino responded that veteran services will still be available in Cornerbrook, and he insisted that caseworkers will make house calls to ailing vets. But Mulcair certainly wouldn't hear it. And as Parliament's first week back winds down, this parliamentary stalemate continues.
Thanks to Nick Taylor-Vasey for Question Period in Review. Now it's time for the Maclean's panel, and this week we're joined by political editor Paul Wells. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
So the first topic is going to be Trudeau's Senate gamble, I guess you could call it. A lot of people are saying that this is just a gimmick or a stunt. That's the critics from the government side, but some who support Trudeau's idea are calling it a bold move. Paul, is it a bold move or a stunt, and will anything really change with the moves that he's made?
I've been awfully skeptical in some public comments this week. I actually don't know whether it'll work. It'll work if the senators who were kicked out of the Liberal caucus decide that they are no longer functionally Liberal and stop showing up at Liberal events and things like that. But on the face of it, it sure did look like the kind of politics that a lot of people have been craving. It was a surprise. It was unexpected. It seemed to change the terms of the debate. But the problems became apparent almost immediately. An hour and a half after Trudeau announced that there were no more Liberal senators, a bunch of Liberal senators showed up and said, here we are. They still hold party cards. They're still welcome at party events. One of the first acts of this new independent caucus was to select a caucus whip, which is a position designed to enforce party discipline. Well, why do you need party discipline if they don't belong to a party anymore? There's a lot of contradictions, and it's going to take a while to see what the effect in reality is.
In terms of political strategy, Aaron, it seems like Trudeau has made a quick move at the start of the spring sitting on some sort of Senate reform, whether you agree with it or not. Does he have the political upper hand on this? Because a quick poll that was done shortly after the announcement found that 53% of Canadians approve of this move.
Yeah, I think he definitely takes control of the conversation to a certain degree, or he definitely sort of imposes his own will on the conversation. Obviously, now the other side, the other sides, the Conservatives and the New Democrats, get to take their own shots at this, get to pick it apart. And now he has to figure out the details and explain how this is going to work. Conceivably, the Liberals knew that was going to happen and thought about that. But they at least sort of get out ahead and put something on the table and get some attention for him and make him look you know, hopefully bold and visionary, or possibly reckless and silly. You know, so it sort of has to play out. I think there's sort of there's a bunch of different ways to look at this in terms of parliamentary procedure, in terms of internal liberal relations, in terms of the future of the Senate. You know, in terms of in the short term, I think there are a lot of complications. In the long term, I think this gets rather profound about how the Senate works. And in that sense, I think this really does have to be regarded as a pretty bold move.
Paul, the Prime Minister originally sort of laughed at this and mocked this idea in the House of Commons. What does he have to do moving forward to try and take Trudeau down a notch after he's taken, I guess, the first big step in some sort of Senate reform?
I think the Prime Minister has decided about 7 or 8 months ago that he is not going to be fighting on a Senate reform battleground. He's going to be fighting on the economy, on management, on the cost of an eventual Liberal or New Democrat government versus the cost of a Conservative government to the taxpayer. I read his speech in Calgary at the Conservative convention last autumn as essentially saying, there's not going to be any Senate reform coming from me as Prime Minister. Now, that sounds like, you know, if we restrict the conversation to Senate reform, that sounds like a lousy position to have. But it's the position that John Chrétien had for a decade as Prime Minister. And it's the position that Stephen Harper has been evolving toward through 8 years as Prime Minister. It's increasingly apparent that Pierre Poilievre, the dynamic, flamboyant minister of democratic reform, is, for all intents and purposes, the minister opposed to democratic reform. But Stephen Harper can live with that.
Now let's switch gears here a little bit, and we'll focus on Julian Fantino, who made headlines because he got into an argument with veterans after showing up an hour late for a meeting that they were supposed to have. They're really upset at him because he's closing down veteran service centers, and they say he didn't give them any respect. They're calling for him to resign. The opposition, NDP, is calling for the exact same thing. He did apologize in the House of Commons, but then went on to attack the opposition. Here's what he had to say.
This is fear-mongering at the height of all this rhetoric. The reality is, Mr. Speaker, that in the past, veterans in need of home care have been served there, and they will continue to be at their own homes.
What do you think of the optics of this for Julian Fantino? Some are speculating that this could be the start of his demise in the Harper cabinet.
Yeah, I think this is a rough week for Mr. Fantino, no matter how you look at it. I think the video of that meeting did not flatter him terribly well. He had a rough week in the House in terms of his performance. He's not exactly the most dynamic and assertive of speakers. And he's got veterans, you know, calling him a bunch of words that I'm not even sure we can say on the radio. You know, this is about as bad a week as you could probably have in that job. At the same time, I'm not quite sure that means he's out. Lots of ministers have had bad weeks, and they weren't dumped from cabinet. And the long-term impact of this, we still don't know. You know, these office closures are going to go ahead. And at that point, it becomes real. And at that point, we find out, is the government right when it says that the delivery is still going to be fine, or are the veterans right when they say the delivery of services isn't going to be fine? And so that's the test. And, you know, so ultimately this gets delayed for a bit, and we, you know, it may be weeks, months, years before we actually know what the meaning of these closures means.
Paul, the Conservatives have always had the military vote and a vote of a lot of veterans. This is not the first time they've had a run-in with veterans, but it's definitely created a lot of passions across the country. What do you think? Could they be possibly losing some military votes as a result of all of this?
They may well. I've long been puzzled by the Harper government's relationship with organized groups representing military veterans, because these groups report that the government is not overly interested in hearing their concerns, and you would think that they would be hand in glove. I mean, if there's anyone likely to be a conservative voter, it's an old guy who used to be in the army, and maybe that the government has been taking it far too much for granted. I do think that most male voters who used to be in the military are likely to vote conservative next time, but this government can't get too frequently in the habit of taking its client groups for granted. Because once in a while, after a while, you lose your client groups. The Bloc Québécois managed to lose Quebec. So nothing is automatic in politics. And then there's the peculiar personality of Julian Fantino. From the moment of his entry into politics as a candidate in the Vaughan by-election a few years ago, he's got just an extraordinarily thin skin. He doesn't seem to believe that anyone has the right to criticize him. And I think it's long past due for somebody he considers a friend to take him aside and say, give your head a shake.
And that's it for the panel this week. But before we go, Aaron, next week we'll be looking ahead to Budget 2014. And after the fiscal plan is tabled, Maclean's will have an in-depth analysis with a post-budget breakfast forum in Ottawa.
That's right. Paul Wells will be joined by former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, Ailish Campbell, the VP for the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, and Laval University economist Stephen Gordon. We'll be going over the politics and policies of Jim Flaherty's latest budget and how it impacts Canadians from coast to coast. For details on the event and to purchase tickets, go to macleans.ca.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thank you to our Washington correspondent, Louisa Savage, former House of Commons law clerk, Rob Walsh, the CEO of Abacus Data, David Coletto, and senior Maclean's correspondent, Charlie Gillis. For more of your politics and your power, join us next week on The Hill.